That was great. I think I'm going to talk a little bit on a different tack. I want to talk a little bit first about the mindset that we're in, we being not just Palestinian activists, but everybody sort of concerned about the situation in Palestine, why we're here, and maybe I want to talk very practically about how we can get out of it, I think maybe put a little bit of meat on the bones of what Norman was talking about, which is, well, I mean, I'll get to it later. I don't want to let the cat out of the bag too soon. But basically, kind of where we are now, I think, is, at least for a lot of us, and I know I felt this in the past, and I know a lot of people who have come to events that I've been at or who are writing in on blogs or listservs, present a great deal of confusion and hopelessness at what's going on now. I think the two-state solution, or I think the Oslo process, I think raised a lot of people's hopes, even if a lot of people, Palestinian, non-Palestinian, Jewish, people who are not Jewish, had nothing to, you know, no direct link to the situation but were concerned, their hopes were raised. And I think now what we're seeing is a long, drawn-out slog where the bodies are piling up, things seem to be getting worse, and it's very easy to get very, very discouraged. I think one of the reasons why that is, or one of the things that we need to keep in mind if we're going to get out of this mindset, I think is what I like to call the Oslo syndrome, which I think a lot of us were infected with for many, many years. And I think, and myself included many years ago, I think what is the Oslo syndrome? The Oslo syndrome is the idea that you can just sort of infinitely go on and negotiate towards some sort of peaceful settlement, whatever that means, without several things. One, without a very clear sense of what peace meant. And there were other assumptions and principles underlying this Oslo syndrome. I mean, one was that peace is the goal, but peace defined as a cessation of hostilities. So, you know, various people, certainly many Palestinians, had a more robust sense of what peace meant. But I think certainly in the press, and certainly a lot of people who were involved in the process and who believed in the process, maybe weren't so sure as to what peace meant beyond simply a cessation of hostilities. That certainly seems to be, practically speaking, the embodiment of Oslo. Second, I think the second critical assumption underpinning the Oslo syndrome is that for it to work, you have to have both sides willing to negotiate in good faith and make a genuine effort at peace. And that has to be the assumption, right? If you're going to support something like the Oslo process, that somehow both sides are going to sit down or are in good faith and are going to sit down and negotiate towards a resolution. Of course, Palestinians say the Israelis are not in good faith. Israelis say the Palestinians are not in good faith. But to believe in this, that's what you have to support. Another thing is that another foundation principle, I think, of the Oslo process is that you can achieve peace just via negotiations without regard to the relative power of the negotiating parties, that you can simply put them in a room together, and that if you somehow marginalize the so-called extremists on both sides, which of course are the problem, right? Then you not the mainstream, then you can achieve peace without regard again to the power differential between the parties. I think these things, all of these three assumptions. Can people hear me? By the way, okay. All of these three assumptions, I'd like to show are fundamentally rotten to the core, are fundamentally wrong. I think one, the notion of peace as the goal, I think we should be realizing now that we're in a lot of trouble if we don't have a more robust, full definition of what peace should be, a lasting, just peace. And of course, you know, we can define it in different ways, but it needs to be a debate that we have. I mean, I think personally that has to include an end to discrimination against Palestinians within the 1948 borders of Israel. That has to include complete equality within the West Bank and Gaza, and it has to include a return of the refugees. Now, these things, for various reasons, and we can discuss them. I won't go into them at length. But whatever your political opinions are, you can't simply support peace for the sake of peace. There has to be a peace that's going to be achieve a certain equilibrium that's going to be politically sustainable. I think another thing, the second assumption is that both sides are willing to negotiate. I think there's actually towards a just peace. I think there are problems on both sides, both on the Palestinian side and the Israeli side. The problem on the Palestinian side is not that they haven't been willing to negotiate, but they've been willing to negotiate too much. And they've been willing, at least the Palestinian leadership, I should say, has been willing to give away everything but the kitchen sink. On the Israeli side, there has been a consistent refusal not to negotiate, but to negotiate in good faith towards a just and lasting peace. And I don't want to get into, again, I don't want to get into the details of this, as Mr. Finkelstein pointed out. There's a lot of stuff being written about this. The historical record is becoming more and more clear every day. There are more books being written, articles being written, clarifying what, not only what happened in 1947-48, but since then, of Israel's intransigence, from actually before the birth of the state, to today. An unwillingness, and I shouldn't say a total unwillingness. There have been some sort of murmurings of dissent. There have been, and certainly on the ground, but I'm talking about the Israeli leadership, and some signs among some leaders that it might be worthwhile for Israel to trade land for peace. But this has never really been a full-fledged commitment to do what it would really take to achieve full equality among Palestinians and Israelis. And the next thing is that you can achieve peace through simple negotiation without regard to the power differential of the parties. What is negotiation? Negotiation is two or more parties getting together and bring, not just sort of talking or coming together because they like each other. By definition, it's two or more parties bringing their outside power to bear upon the negotiating process, upon a process of getting what they want. Bringing their external political, military, economic power, social power to bear on getting what they want for themselves, not for the other party. Therefore, when one party has all of the cards, all of the power, and the other party has none or very little, negotiation not only won't work, but it can't work. So you can't simply sit in a room with each other without regard to the fact that the Palestinians have no leverage and expect to achieve a lasting peace or a just peace, a peace that's worth having. So what's next? War? No, I don't think so. I think that's also been tried, and I think there is another path. I think the path that has increasingly been popular, I think for good reason, I don't want to use the word popular, but been growing on the grassroots level is BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And that's really what I want to talk about, because I think that is going to be how we're going to actualize this, the satyagraha, that principle of taking truth to power, right? So I think, what is BDS? And some of you, I know some of you have heard of it. I know some of you are working on the issue. Some of you may be very, very skeptical. I was certainly a couple of years ago. BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions. Boycott is very simply refusing to buy products of Israel, or however you define it. Some people might refuse to buy products that are made in the territories. Some might refuse to buy all products made in Israel. Some might refuse to buy products of companies that do business with Israel, whatever. That's the principle. Divestment is pulling your money out of companies, stocks, for example, or pension funds that either do business with Israel or sell arms with Israel or whatever. And sanctions, of course, are government mechanisms to isolate economically and militarily a particular country. Where do we come up with this idea? I mean, why do some of us think that it's so effective? I think one is the South African model has proven very, very illustrative, because there are huge similarities. I think, of course, a lot of dissimilarities, but also very important similarities between the South African model, what happened there, and what's happening in Palestine. I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence that Desmond Tutu himself referred to apartheid in the Holy Land, and has said that in some instances, it's what's going on in Palestine is worse than what happened in South Africa. COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, has come out with a very, very strong, very good resolution on boycotting Israel. Ronnie Kasrils, who's, I believe, the information minister of South Africa, has also come out, who has also come out very strongly in support of a boycott, divestment, sanctions against Israel. So, you know, what are the advantages and disadvantages? You know, I think one idea is that it really breaks through this mental state of thinking that all we can do is sit back and hope that the Palestinian leadership or the Palestinians elect a leadership that will negotiate towards a just peace. It empowers us because BDS, I think by its definition, is a grassroots movement. It is empowering both to us and for Palestinians, right? So, well, I mean, I'm a Palestinian, so I have to count myself in that category, although I live here. Another thing is that it empowers Palestinians at the bargaining table or at some potential future bargaining table. The idea is that, what was the idea in South Africa? You raise the costs of apartheid because the average South African white citizen is deeply invested in apartheid, not only economically, but ideologically. The same is true in Israel of Israeli Jews. And that the idea is that they're not simply going to let go because you come and show them pictures of crying Palestinians. You know, it's moral exhortation. Babies with their heads shot off is simply not going to do it. I'm sorry. So the idea then is that you raise the cost of occupation in a nonviolent way, starting with, for example, boycotting products that are made in the territories. Ultimately, you want to get to the point that they did in South Africa, and it took about half a century to do so, where you have a blanket boycott. So, for example, in South Africa, so, you know, beginning in the 80s, they had a very difficult time in repressing the non, quote unquote, non-white population, the Africans, because they couldn't find parts for their airplanes and their tanks because they couldn't buy new ones. I mean, that was certainly part, but inflation was rampant. I mean, these are parts of the power mechanism. And so that's kind of at the cusp between the idea of truth and power. I think we need to know the truth. We need to be equipped with the history. We need to be equipped with the facts. But I think the idea of BDS is an empowering movement, both, you know, for us and Palestinians on the ground, because it gives them leverage to come. Ultimately, that's what happened in South Africa. Ultimately, when Nelson Mandela came to sit across from the table with F.W. de Klerk, he had a reason to be listened to from the Afrikaner's perspective. There are some arguments that, some common arguments, and some of them are a little bit more, how am I doing on time, by the way? 3 more minutes? Some of them are more sincere than others, and I'll go through them very quickly, and I don't think we'll have time for them all. But, you know, some people say, well, you're just going to alienate the Israeli progressives. One answer that a friend of mine in Adala likes to give is that, well, what Israeli progressives? It's actually a very small segment of the population. The vast majority of Israelis are deeply invested in maintaining the occupation, maintaining Israeli oppression. Another argument is that, well, it's very negative. It's focused on, you know, attacking Israel. Well, it's not attacking Israel. It's putting political pressure on Israel. And it's not negative. I think it's actually very, very positive. It's empowering. It's coming to terms with the reality that our leaders, our American leaders, leaders in Europe, across the world, are not going to act until we do. So it's, you know, the old idea of that when the people lead, the leaders will follow, right? Ultimately, like sanctions, for example, that's the last step. That's going to happen in a half century. It's not going to happen right now. It's you and I and Palestinians who issued the first calls, or actually renewed the first calls for boycott, divestment, sanctions within the last 5 years. It is us helping them. It is you and me getting together and putting genuine pressure on companies, on individuals, on institutions, and ultimately on governments to do something about this. So I think it's very, very positive, and that's how we need to see it. It's not a negative thing. And there are some others. I don't want to go through all of them, but I think, you know, in order for us to really see how we can take the truth, because as Mr. Finkelstein pointed out, we have the arguments. We have the law. I mean, that's a kind of a no-brainer, right? And if you can sit down, somebody, you know, often at these events, somebody will come who will kind of stand up and argue for Israel. Many of these people, not all of them, but many, often if you sit down with them and kind of talk with them for a little while and tell them what the truth is, they start to think a little bit and they start to doubt themselves. We have the facts. That's not the issue. And thanks to, you know, people like Benny Morris, although I kind of grudgingly thank him, but he is a good scholar, even though politically he's kind of somewhere to the right of, oh, I don't know, Hitler, thank you, or, or Ilan Pappe or some of these other authors who are doing good work. The facts are on our side. The law is on our side. Somehow we need to actuate that truth into genuine political power. And I think the way we're going to do that is through a grassroots movement like BDS. So that, I think that's, and if you want to know more, I was going to bring a magazine today, Majdal, which is issued by the, by Badil, which is the Palestinian Refugees Resource Center in Bethlehem. I couldn't get to bring them, but if you want to know more, come talk to me. Miren, some of you know Miren, or De Gaulle, or I think Noram is back there, Yoram is back there, and maybe some others who were involved in Adala and who you know, this is not a pitch for Adala, but, you know, I think if we can get, you know, every year, if we can double or increase by, you know, 50% the number of people involved in this movement, you know, maybe within our lifetime, as it took with South Africa, maybe within our lifetime, we will actually be able to see Palestinians and Jews, and I actually support a one-state solution, Palestinian and Jewish children sitting together at the same table and eating in full equality. That's it. Thank you.
So let me just remind you really quickly before we turn it over to Larry Hamm, our third speaker. Once again, if you have questions or if questions are coming into your mind, please do raise your hand. We have Patricia over here who will bring you a card so you could write your question. And once we get to the question and answer, we will get to everybody's questions. So, Larry, we did an introduction. You want me to reintroduce you? We did the introduction. Or you want to just jump in?
All right.
Okay. Here's Larry Hamm. All right.